The birthday parade reverses and files out. 30 seconds later, while I'm pouring my undrunk coffee down the sink, Patrick comes in.
"Stephen's gone," he says quietly.
I think of gone in every other semantic sense. Gone to the store, gone running, gone out for morning pizza, gone crazy. I don't think of it in the simplest of terms. I don't think of gone meaning absent, not here, as in my dream. I don't think of it as in gone from this life, dead. Patrick holds out a sheet of notebook paper.
"This was in his room, on his pillow."
It could be worse, I think, reading Stephen's scribble. Still, that horrible it, is enough to take the wind out of me. Gone to look for Julia. Love you, S. In 4 days, everything has changed from lousy to shit.
"Should we call the police?" I say.
Patrick shakes his head as if he knows what I'm thinking.
"Probably better not to."
He touches my arm and takes the empty coffee mug from my hand without asking, "What's the matter with your coffee?" or eyeing the streaks of brown in the sink. What he does say is,
"I haven't been a very good husband, have I?"
Then, like magnets, we're together, attached, holding each other up. He touches that soft spot behind my ear with a finger, and I feel my pulse beat a rhythm, syncopated at first, then steady. It's odd to think of love at a time like this, with our son gone and the brown sludge of coffee in the sink, but Patrick's hands roam down my neck, across my back, and forward to my breasts, which swell in the silk nightie, responding to his touch in that automatic way the flesh has of pricking up, even when the mind tells it not to.
"I can't be late,"
I say, pulling back from him. I also can't lie under my husband this morning, thinking about the first time, the time we made Stephen. I'm also thinking about what Patrick would have done if, instead of Julia, it was me who Reverend Carl tore from my home and made stand in front of television cameras before shipping me off to a life of silence and servitude. Would he come after me? Lorenzo would, but not Patrick.
"Where do you think he went?"
I say, turning on the shower.
"Stephen, I mean."
"Julia might be anywhere. Up the coast, inland, across the country in a California orange grove. Finding her would be like finding a black cat in a coal cellar." Patrick shakes his head.
"I don't think so. Let me show you something."
He leaves me in the bathroom and goes to the nightstand on his side of the bed.
"What the hell?"
The lie's already prepared, and easier to recite when I'm not looking him in the eyes. "A damn handle came off last night. Don't you remember?" There's a pause while he thinks this over. Finally, I hear the jangle of keys and a single perplexed, "huh," from the bedroom before I escape into the shower.
"I'll make you some tea if you want," Patrick calls. "When you're done, come to my office. I think I know where Stephen's headed."
I take the quickest shower of my life, comb out unwashed hair, and dress in loose jeans and a linen shirt that I don't have to tuck in. Screw the dress code. I'm hot, rushed, and pregnant. Then I go down the hall into Patrick's study. Reverend Carl's face fills the screen, and his hands are held up as if in prayer. It's his preferred speaking pose. The news camera trained on him tracks back, opening up the shot to reveal the rest of the stage. Julia King is unrecognizable. They've shaved her, of course. I expected that. I didn't expect the job to be so half-assed, like an amateur sheep shearing by a blind man with palsy. Clumps of remaining hair stick in rusty patches on her head. "What did they do, use a dull straight razor?" I say, not taking my eyes off the image on Patrick's laptop. Stephen has seen this, was forced to watch and join in his classmates' name-calling. Reverend Carl calls his audience to prayer and bows his head.
"Lord, forgive our wayward daughter and guide her as she joins her sisters in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Amen."
A chorus of shouts and hisses follows the prayer. A few people echo amen, but mostly it's a hate fest. Reverend Carl presses the air under his raised hands and calls for silence. But when he lifts his head toward the cameras, I see the faintest of smiles on his lips. Now the camera closes in, tight, on Julia's tear-streaked face. Her lips tremble, and her eyes search from left to right, looking for a shred of sympathy among the shouters. Reverend Carl's hand appears on her shoulder, and she shirks away, but the hand seems only to clench more tightly, fingers digging into her clavicle under the gray material. It fits high on her neck and has long sleeves. She must be dying in this heat. It isn't the first time I think about how much I hate Reverend Carl Corbin, but it is the first time I want to kill him. 49. If I'd spent my last few minutes at home looking out our front window instead of unknotting my hair, I might have seen the anonymous black SUV parked across the street, its engine running and puffing out streams of exhaust smoke. But I didn't. By the time I walk out the side door and start my car, it's too late. Dell, the mailman, is already up the porch steps, courier bag over his shoulder, his key to our mailbox in one hand. He waves to me, and I wave back through the Honda's rear window. The realization hits me like a tidal wave. Keys, an envelope, Dell peeking inside the mailbox yesterday and removing a single item, Sharon warning me about an underground organization that's using a mailman as its go-between, and finally, Patrick's words last night after he told me what Olivia had done to herself there in her bedroom with the dictaphone repeating its endless loop of her own words. We're doing everything we can. When the dots connect, I'm left with one terrible, frightening, and at the same time, relieving explanation. Patrick isn't working for the government. He's working against it. I pull halfway out of the driveway, stopping when I'm in line with the porch. Dell opens the mailbox, careful to shield his hands from the street and the porch camera. I want to shout at him, "Stop! Stop! Don't open it!" He slides the manila envelope out, holding it close and hiding it in his courier bag before relocking the mailbox. He won't hear Poe's silent steps behind him, coming up the walk, climbing the porch stairs. He won't hear the quiet click and hum of the black stun gun in Poe's massive right hand, or the crackle as it presses against his ribs, shocking him twice, first in his body, then in his mind. Poe turns toward me and waves me down the driveway as if to say, "Move along now, nothing to see here." And now two more men rush up to the house from the black car across the street. They lift Dell by the armpits, dragging his ragdoll body down the steps, along the path, and to the car, while I wait helplessly to see if Poe rings our doorbell and repeats the show with Patrick. He doesn't. He only walks away from our house, folds himself into the rear seat of the black car next to an unconscious Dell, and waits for me to drive away. Then the black car pulls from the curb, following my Honda all the way to Connecticut Avenue, where it turns and heads south. It crosses my mind to reverse course and go to the Ray's farm to warn Sharon, but I shunt the thought aside. I'd be caught, or too late, or, best case, have Morgan all over my ass for not showing up to work on time. As I weave through morning traffic, I process the morning's events. Poe must think Dell had the envelope all along, that he was about to deliver it, perhaps to some other address. I don't have an eidetic memory, not even close, but I do have a head for text. In a previous life, or in a future life if I had access to books, I might make a decent editor. Not that I can write worth a shit, but I can process mistakes, and the ones I'm processing as I wind through traffic on my way to meet Lorenzo and Lynn are the twin typos I found in the red and gold packets inside a manila envelope. The errors aren't the only things running through my mind like rabid hamsters on a wheel. The very nature of three distinct teams duplicating one another's work shouldn't merit classified status. And my team was never classified. Or if it was, our president declassified it in a press conference 3 days ago. I park the Honda in my designated spot, between Lorenzo's Mustang and the space where Lynn's smart car should be, but isn't. Inside the building, a soldier waves me through the checkpoint after taking my purse and laying it on the X-ray machine's belt. What's this? I say.
New security procedures, the soldier says, watching me. This time, there's no smile, no cheery, have a nice day, only a pair of eyes, narrowed into slits, watching me from under the brim of his cap as I collect my bag and walk toward the bank of elevators where Morgan is waiting with crossed arms.
You're late, he says.
I was working through the night, I lie, and step into the open elevator. Morgan follows.
You're not supposed to take work home, Jean. Or did you forget that one simple rule?
I spin toward him, wishing I'd worn more than a pair of sandals so I could look down at the bastard. Still, our eyes are even. No, I didn't forget, Morgan. I don't forget things. But I've got a working brain, so unless you want me to leave that locked up in your fucking lab, get off my back and let me do what I need to do, you little prick.
I won't stand for that kind of talk, he says.
Then sit, or lie down, or crawl in a hole. I don't care. I'm busy.
I'm writing this up. I'm sending a report to...
To who? To the president? Fine. Tell him I'm taking the rest of the month off for bad behavior. I punch the closed doors button on the elevator before slipping out, leaving Morgan to fester.
What the hell was that all about?
Lorenzo says. He's in the corridor between the elevator and the lab, dressed casually but smartly in a polo and khakis under his white coat.
I hate that piece of shit, I say.
Where's Lynn?
Hasn't come in yet. Guess we have the lab all to ourselves.
Mischief lights up his eyes as he closes the gap between us. A quickie on one of the epoxy resin counters isn't part of my schedule today, but we do need to talk. Show me what you've been working on, I say, inserting my keycard into the main door of the laboratory. Mice and rabbits greet us with a cacophony of squeaks and chatter. I wish Lynn were here, not only because I don't want to inject the animals myself. What I know needs to be shared. Lorenzo turns on the tap in the biochem lab and starts washing his hands, rubbing soap in between each finger, scrubbing his nails one at a time, inspecting each digit.
Well?
The three teams. They're sort of the same, but different. I think back to the goals statements, to the way two of the teams seemed identical in one way and two others in another. All because of one little word. Anti. At the time, sitting cross-legged on the cool of the bathroom floor, I thought it was a typo. Lorenzo continues the charade of washing his hands, turning up the water, leaning in closer to the faucet. Our team's goal is development of the anti-Wernicke serum, I say. At first, I thought the gold team's goal was identical, but then it hit me. There's nothing top secret about what we're doing here. I mean, what you and Lynn and I are working on.
You don't advertise classified shit to a press conference,
Lorenzo says, agreeing. Right. So the gold team's packet left out one word. He raises an eyebrow.
Anti, I whisper. That team isn't developing an anti-Wernicke serum, and the red team isn't working on water solubility for an anti-Wernicke serum. The anti was missing there, too.
Holy shit,
he says, staring at his hands.
You're sure it wasn't a typo?
No, I'm not sure. I can't be sure, but it makes sense. It's the only thing that explains why the materials are classified and why Morgan has a single binder labeled Project Wernicke. We'd always called it anti-Wernicke, or later, Wernicke X, just like you wouldn't be working on a cancer cure and name your study Project Cancer.
Not unless you were developing cancer in a lab, he says. It sounds wrong.
I tell him about Patrick and Dell, the locked mailbox, Poe's men coming to take Dell away this morning. They know, I say. Poe or someone knows there's an underground operation, and they know they've found out what's really going on. For a long time, we look at each other over the running water, careful to keep our heads bent toward the sink. There isn't anything to say, because we both know our work is being reverse-engineered somewhere in this building. Whether Reverend Carl is behind it, or Morgan, or the president, or the pure movement doesn't matter. It could be all of them, all working to create a serum that doesn't cure aphasia, but causes it. 50.
Lorenzo and I prep two groups of mice for injections. Each set will receive one of the two neuroproteins he's been formulating, and, with luck, we'll know which direction we need to take by the end of the day, when half of the mice are dead. As I remove the tiny creatures from their cages and shave a square patch of fur from them, one by one, a single word ping-pongs around my brain. Why? The answer comes much too easily, also in the form of a single word. Silence. Lorenzo reaches over and takes the brown mouse from my shaking hands.
I'll do it,
he says, guiding the clippers along its flank.
There. You put Mickey in the Group 1 cage. And don't worry, I'll take care of the injections.
I'm that bad?
Let's say you're a little unsteady this morning. No big deal.
He pats me on the shoulder, and I jump.
One thing at a time, Jana.
I watch his hands with their long fingers, tipped with calluses from years of fretwork and strumming, as he sedates the next mouse, waits for it to relax in his palm, and shaves another square patch.
This one's Group 2,
he says, handing its limp body back to me. Another Mickey or Minnie goes into the second cage.
They're monsters, I say.
Lorenzo nods. He knows I don't mean the mice. Now it's two winters ago, and I'm back in my own living room sitting next to Olivia King as she sips coffee and watches Jackie go to battle with three pure women, their pastel twin sets a quiet contrast to Jackie's red power suit. Olivia is nodding at the twin set women, shaking her head violently every time Jackie opens her mouth. Someone should shut that woman up, Olivia says. Permanently.
Oh, Olivia. I think, what the hell did you expect?
They'll start with the women in the camps, I suppose. Jackie, Julia, Annie Wilson from down the street. We won't see any of it televised. Next, Reverend Carl will round up people like Dell and Sharon, squelching the last hope of any resistance. Before they take away his voice, though, they'll go to work on Dell, maybe use his three daughters as an incentive. And Dell, of course, will talk. What father wouldn't? Patrick will be next in line. I feel my heart stop as I think of the methods they'll use on him, of the threats to Sonia that will encourage him to speak, and so on, until every last member of what must already be a threadbare operation is found, forced to talk, and ultimately silenced. With my own damnable creation. I don't believe this will be the end. Lorenzo touches my shoulder again.
We're all finished for now. You okay?
I shake my head. Minus a husband, and plus the wrist counter that goes back on once I've finished my work here, I'll have no means to take care of a house or children. Stephen might manage to hold things together for a while, if Stephen ever comes back. If not, with Patrick's parents both dead and mine in Italy, the McClellan clan is finished, extinct. And then there's my baby. Lorenzo's baby. I've spent so much of my time thinking about what used to be, how I used to be, but the future always remained a blur. Up until now, that is. Now I see ghosts of years to come, only malformed swirls at first, then coalescing into razor-sharp pictures in full color. Me, babbling nonsense phrases after they inject me with a serum of my own making. Me, bent-backed and gray, pulling at a patch of weeds with hands I no longer recognize. Me, lying on a cot under a thin blanket shivering in winter. Me, vacant-eyed and perhaps teetering on the edge between awareness and insanity, wondering where they all went to. Stephen, Sam, Leo, Sonia, baby. Only when Lorenzo takes me by the arm and pulls me up do I realize I've been sitting on the lab floor, my back resting against the bottom row of empty wire cages.
It's all right, Jana,
he says, brushing the tears from my eyes with his fingers.
It's all right.
It isn't, you know.
It will be.
I want to bury myself inside him, but I remember the cameras. I'm fine, I say, straightening myself out. Let's get on with the injections. When I first started experiments with lab animals, I had one golden rule. Don't name them. In other words, don't think of them as pets. Don't think of them as anything other than a way to get from point A to point B. Think of them as test tubes or petri dishes or microscope slides, nothing more than innate vehicles to fill and observe. While I hold each tiny mouse for Lorenzo to inject with a potion that will either cure it or kill it, all I can think of is the names I've given them. Jackie, Lynn, Jean. 51. Lorenzo's idea is risky, but necessary. After we've called upstairs for an assistant to clean up the lab and filed a report for Morgan, I leave first, retracing my steps through the security checkpoint. There's a new pair of soldiers on guard during the afternoon shift, their uniforms pressed to sharp creases, their boots shined to a high polish that reflects the entry vestibule's fluorescent lights. My purse goes back on the conveyor belt to be scanned while one of the soldiers pats me down, his hands running short, swift arcs over my hips, back, stomach, breasts. Once cleared, I walk out into the May sunshine. May 31st, I think, is my birthday, the day Stephen ran off with a wad of cash from Patrick's wallet, and the day I'll meet Lorenzo for another secret rendezvous in a rented Maryland crab shack. We decided to take opposite routes from the city, so I follow traffic south toward the highway that cuts through Washington, past the fish market that's still there at the waterside. I wonder where the fish come from. Maine? North Carolina? Probably both. I don't wonder who works in the processing factories, gutting and scaling, packing and freezing. Maybe one day I'll have a job doing the same. Long hours, no pay. Permanent stench of fish in my skin. Lynn was wrong about the economy falling apart. It might not be thriving, but the machine chugs along at a constant, working speed. Our workforce wasn't cut in half, only reassembled and redistributed. Men who performed unskilled labor were replaced with whoever the pure deemed unworthy of hanging about in society. Industries, and that all-encompassing industry, government, cherry-picked, freshly graduated males from the country's top universities to fill the gaps women left. CEOs, doctors, lawyers, engineers. It was an eminently doable reworking of the system. I've been pushing Stephen out of my mind all day, and now the sadness uncorks itself and spills out of me. There were so many times I wanted to blame him, but I can't. Monsters aren't born, ever. They're made, piece by piece and limb by limb, artificial creations of madmen who, like the misguided Frankenstein, always think they know better. He won't get far, anyway, even with the cash. Stephen will find his way back home. This is one thing I have to believe. The traffic subsides at the same time my tears run out, just as I pull the Honda onto the exit ramp and turn eastward toward the Chesapeake Bay. That land of William Styron and blue crabs and sailboats skimming over calm waters. It's a long drive, but a quiet one, and it gives me time to think. If the Wernicke cure works, which I expect it will, I'll ask Morgan to have a dose sent to my mother in the Italian hospital. That small benefit is a single bright ray of sun in an otherwise drab landscape. Not much, but it's something to hold on to. Lorenzo's car sits in the driveway of the shack, radiating, distorting waves of heat from its hood. Of course, he's arrived first. You can take the mad Italian driver out of Italy, but you can't take the madness out of him. I drive past it, up to the next lot, which has stood vacant since the time Lorenzo rented our place. The rule is, first one arriving parks at the shack, second in the empty lot. I've never been first. He's in the kitchen, or what would be a kitchen if it contained more than a sink, a two-burner stove, and a cube-shaped refrigerator for water and wine. We never wasted time cooking in this place. Not food, anyway. I had everything planned out during the drive. Get in, talk, and get out. But when he lays a hand on my right cheek, the plans all go to hell. It isn't Lorenzo leading me to the small bedroom off the kitchen, a dark and wood-paneled room with a single window we've never opened. Instead, I take his hand from where it rests on my cheek and lead him. The last time, there wasn't any talk. I still had my wrist counter on, and Lorenzo stayed silent, perhaps out of solidarity. He didn't whisper my name as Patrick did, and he had no words of pity. He simply didn't speak as he moved over me and in me. We're still quiet today, our hands and bodies reciting the words for us, but inside me are the clangs and horns of an orchestra playing full out. After one round of love, we go at it again, this time slowly and unrushed, as if we had days or years, not hours, not fractions of hours. When he finally softens, in every sense of the word, Lorenzo lies on top of me, covering me with his body like a shield that blacks out the world.
"I can get you out," he says.
For a moment, I'm not sure what he means, but he reaches over to where his jeans lie with mine, twin puddles of denim on the pine floor, and comes back to me with a slim, burgundy booklet in his hand. I recognize it immediately, the cog wheel and five pointed stars surrounded by branches, olive for peace, oak for strength. "How did you get this?" I say, leafing through the new passport. Page 2 has my picture, but another woman's name, Grazia Francesca Rossi. The birth date matches my age, roughly.
"I have friends," he says. "Well, friends who can be bought."
"Who's Grazia?" Rossi is a common surname in Italy, but the coincidence seems over the top. "Your sister?" Lorenzo shakes his head.
"No, I don't have a sister. Grazia was my wife."
He doesn't wait for me to ask before explaining.
"She died 5 years ago."
"Oh," I say, as if he's given me a piece of ordinary news, a weather report, the outcome of the World Series, where the next Winter Olympics will be hosted. I don't ask questions, and he doesn't offer answers. "I can't leave, you know." There's no argument from him, only his hand running down my body, starting at my collarbone and stopping an inch above my sex.
"What if it's a girl, Jana?"
52. What if it is a girl? I lie on my side, one finger tracing the gold emblem on the front of my passport, this gift that cost Lorenzo the earth, my ticket out of hell. Our ticket out, I think, holding my other hand to my belly. Only an hour ago I was thinking about Styron, and now here I am, his short-lived Sophie, lying with her man, a terrible, Solomonic choice dangling in the space above us. Which one do I save? "How long do I have to think about it?" I ask, here in the dark of our bedroom. We both know I don't have long, not once we stage our first trial on Monday. "We could stall the project," I say, "by a few weeks."
"Would that be enough?"
"No." Suddenly, I'm thinking of a beach from more than 20 years ago. Not a posh beach, not Cancun or Bermuda or anything. Jackie and I could barely scrape together the cash for a couple of nights in a crappy motel with no ocean view. But we went every summer to Rehoboth to drink beer and sun ourselves and escape the madness of grad school for a few days. The last time we were there, I told her I'd socked away some money. We could stay another day, maybe two.
"Would that be enough?"
Jackie said, sucking on a Corona she'd plucked from the cooler and squeezed a wedge of lime into. "No," I laughed.
"It all ends, Jeannie, sooner or later. You can't stay in the vacation bubble forever, you know."
I don't remember whether we stayed the extra day in that motel room or whether we drove back the following morning. What I do remember is thinking, once we hauled the beach bags and suitcases full of bikinis and suntan lotion into our apartment, that it really didn't matter. Sooner or later, we'd be right there in our Georgetown hovel, throwing leftovers turned science experiments out of the fridge,
checking the piled-up mail, losing our tans, diving back into the academic grind. Jackie, once again, was right. Sooner or later, it all ends. It crossed my mind, I tell Lorenzo. When Reverend Carl first asked me, I thought maybe he'd invented the whole story about the president's brother's head injury. I remember standing in my kitchen, wondering if he'd take my work and reverse engineer it. I flop back on the pillow, wishing it would swallow me whole.
Not your fault, Lorenzo says.
But it is. And my fault didn't start when I signed Morgan's contract on Thursday. My fault started 2 decades ago, the first time I didn't vote, the umpteen times I told Jackie I was too busy to go on one of her marches, or make posters, or call my congressman.
Tell me I don't have to leave this bed,
I say.
Ever.
Lorenzo checks his watch.
The mice have 2 more hours to go. It'll take 45 minutes to drive back to the lab.
An hour, I say, for me, at least. Remember, I'm not Mario Andretti.
So we have an hour.
I say I can't, but I do. And this time, I'm not silent. I scream with my body and my voice, nails digging into the bedclothes or into Lorenzo's skin. I bite and moan and scratch like a feral cat on amphetamines, letting out all the stress and all the fear and all the hate, pouring it from me into him. He takes every last drop of it, then gives some back, pulling my hair, gnawing at my lips and breasts, attacking me with kisses. It's violent, but it's still love, a tandem scream from us to the rest of the world, and all of the world's sins. 53. We allow ourselves 15 minutes to clean up and decide what happens next. There's another lab, I say, letting the shower rain over my skin. The hot water stings when it hits an abrasion. I look down and realize I'm a mess. Oh, Christ.
Your face is fine. Perfect, actually,
Lorenzo says, working up a lather in my hair.
And you're right. There has to be another lab. But we won't get inside it.
We have to. He rinses off and leaves me to deal with the rat's nest my hair has become. 2 minutes later, he's back in the cramped bathroom, leaning one hip on the sink while he talks.
Listen to me, Jana. Even if we get into their other lab, which we won't, what then? Arson? We'd be caught. Steal their supplies? Sure. And if we weren't caught by those security creeps with an armful of vials on our way out the door, which, by the way, we would be, then what happens? It's the government, honey. It's a machine. They'll only start again. By next year, you and Lynn will be picking fish guts out of your nails.
Lorenzo pauses, then says,
If you stay.
I consider this. He's right. So we do nothing? I step out of the shower and start toweling. Nothing at all?
No, we do something. We get the fuck out of here.
I have kids, Enzo. 4 of them. Even if I could leave Patrick, he looks me up and down, pausing at the swell of my belly.
Well, I have one too. Do I get a say?
You could take her. It, him, whatever it is. You could take her away. Even as I speak the words, I know it's impossible. By the time this baby's come to term, who knows what new enforcements will be in place.
We both know that can't happen.
He says, sterner now, decisive.
It's now or never, Jana.
No, it's next week or never. I have a test on Monday and should have the results by midweek.
And?
And here, in this crab shack that smells of sweat and semen and love, I make my decision. If it's a girl, I'll go with you, as soon as you want. He waits, watching me dress and comb out my hair. He waits an eternity before speaking. Then he pulls me close, whispering into my ear.
Okay, Jana. Okay.
His voice sounds strong, but I know he's praying to a god neither of us believes in that the genetic analysis comes back as a double X, a baby girl.
Come on, I say. We need to get back. I'll go first.
The air is cooler now, and the few spare vacation houses cast shadows where, when I arrived at the shack, there were none. I click open the Honda, climb in, and think about what I would pray for, a boy or a girl. Stay or leave. Watch Sonia taken away from me? Or, in a marginally more pleasant scenario, watch while some uniformed male nurse, following orders, injects her with a concoction that will take all her words away forever. I don't think I could stand it either way. I pray to a god I don't believe in for a girl, so I don't have to witness any of this. And I pray to that same god for a boy, so I never have to leave my Sonia. 54. Lynn has not made an appearance today, the soldiers at the security checkpoint tell me as they pat me down for a third time.
No, ma'am, one says.
He's the same spit-polished youngster who frisked me when I left. The name above his left breast pocket is Petrosky W. I need to see Morgan, I say.
Who?
Dr. LeBron. Calling him Dr. Anything brings a nasty taste of bile to my mouth. He doesn't deserve the title. Sergeant Spit and Polish Petrosky checks my bag, even though it's already been x-rayed, and nods to his partner. After two rings, Morgan picks up.
What?
He says. The soldier picks up my keycard, turning it over in his hands, reading my name.
Dr. McClellan says she needs to see you. Tell her I'm busy.
That strident voice, as squeaky as a lab rat's, pierces the air between the soldier and me. It's how I think of Morgan, as a rat, a foul and vicious but not too bright creature. Tell him we're about to check on the mice, I say to the soldier, but I want to brief him first. Again, the squeak, this time tinged with a thin hopefulness, says,
Send her up, with an escort.
30 seconds later, I'm in an elevator with a man, no, a boy, not much older than Stephen. For no reason I understand, I think of what he might have been like as a college kid, sucking cheap beer through a funnel bong, pledging at a fraternity, dragging himself sleepy-eyed to an early morning calculus class. Did you go to college? I ask.
Yes, ma'am.
What did you major in? I'm thinking poli-sci or pre-law or history. He stiffens next to me, but doesn't turn.
Philosophy, ma'am.
They teach you how to fire one of those in Epistemology 101? I say, nodding to the service piece on his hip. I expect him to clam up, tell me it's none of my business.
Move along now, ma'am. Nothing to see here.
But he doesn't. Instead, his lower lip trembles slightly, and I see the boy inside Sergeant Petrosky's smart uniform.
No, ma'am, he says.
The old saying goes, keep a stiff upper lip. But as I watch his reflection in the polished steel walls of the elevator, I think that it isn't the upper lip we need to worry about. The bottom one gives our terror away. Every single time. I decide not to torture him with further questions. Petrosky's only a boy, after all. A kid who took a wrong turn at a sign somewhere along life's road, not so different from Stephen. Although Stephen, after a brief detour, turned back. Maybe this one will, too. There's still time, I say, not really knowing whether I'm talking to the young soldier or to myself. The elevator doors slide open into their hidden pockets at the same time a mechanical voice, female, it turns out, says, Floor 5, and the young Petrosky turns slightly, extending his arm, showing me out. It's so quick, I almost miss it, the 3 measured blinks of his eyes. Blink once for yes, twice for no, or 3 times for not pure. I bat my eyes at him, a gesture that the cameras might pick up, or not, but if they do, I can make something up. A bug in my eye, a stray lash, strain. Let's go, I say. On Saturday afternoon, the 5th floor corridor should be a ghost town. All those generals and admirals out golfing or batting tennis balls or playing Axis and Allies in their basements. But every office door is open, and behind every door is a man at a desk, busy and focused. The third door on my right, after we've left the elevator bank, has a brass nameplate with Winters J on it. Inside, the man behind the desk looks up from his work, scowls, and returns to reading. He's the same one I saw yesterday afternoon, and the same name I read on the gold team's list last night.
"Here we are," Sergeant Petrosky says. He knocks, three sharp military raps at Morgan's closed door.
"Enter."
Petrosky turns on one polished heel.
"Good luck, ma'am. On the project, I mean. I'll take you back down when you're ready."
Morgan stands when I enter, offers me a seat, and punches a button on his desk phone.
"Andy, bring coffee for two."
He looks at me.
"Milk? Sugar?"
"Black," I say, returning the smile. If he's feeling magnanimous, why not join the party? Even if his eyes do remind me of the lab mice Lorenzo injected this morning. He relays the order to Andy, his assistant, and sits in the chair behind his desk, the chair that he's ratcheted up so that he looks larger. It must be painful, I think, to sit like that without your feet touching the floor.
"So, progress?"
I check the clock above Morgan's head. "We'll know in about 30 minutes. Where's Lynn?" The non-sequitur slows him, as if someone has just offered him ice cream, then given him a choice between anchovy and tuna. As he processes what I've said, the corners of his mouth turn, first down, then straight, then up again.
"That's terrific. Think we'll be ready to roll tomorrow?"
"Our first subject is scheduled for Monday."
"Change it to tomorrow," he says. Then, "If you can, Jean. Only if you can."
I take the cue to play nice. He wants something. I want something.
"Absolutely."
Morgan relaxes now, and Andy knocks softly before bringing in a tray. "Let me," I say, tipping the carafe over two white mugs with a blue P emblem.
"Listen, I'm sorry I yelled at you earlier. We're all under a great deal of stress, Jean. Peace."
"Sure, peace." I almost remind Morgan that the word for peace and the word for submission are virtually identical in some languages, but there's no point in confusing him. I need the bastard too much. "I have a small favor to ask. My mother's suffered a burst aneurysm, left hemisphere, Wernicke's area." Morgan's eyes narrow, but he says nothing. It's hard to tell whether these eyes convey concern or sympathy or distrust, so I press on, feeling my way one step at a time. "I was wondering, since we're starting the clinical trials anyway, could we put her on the subject list?"
"Of course we can. Bring her in tomorrow and set it up."
"Well," I say, "that's going to be difficult. She's in Italy." He sits back, one elbow on each of the chair's armrests, his right ankle resting on his left knee, as if he's trying to occupy as much space as possible.
"Italy," he repeats.
"Yes, you know, land of pizza and ass-kicking coffee. Unlike the crap Andy brought in, I think."
"I have a problem with that, Jean. Relations between us and Europe are..."
He searches for a word.
"Not good."
Just like Morgan. Of all the English terms he has to pick from, tenuous, strained, problematic, tense, adverse, hostile, unpropitious, Morgan chooses not good. He continues, his eyes moving slightly up and to the left, a sure sign he's creating a lie or holding back, but I don't think Morgan's aware of the subconscious tick. Most liars aren't.
"You understand, don't you, Jean? I mean, we can't just send a valuable product like this over to Europe, not with the current climate."
My coffee tastes more bitter with each sip.
"What if you sent me? I could administer the serum and..."
"Ha!" The single syllable is more bark than word.
"You know the travel rules,"
he says, softening, but only slightly.
"No way." "How could I have forgotten?"
"All right, then. Lorenzo, he can travel."
Morgan shakes his head, as if he's about to explain a difficult mathematical construct to a child, a concept so far outside my capacity to understand that he thinks breaking it down would be useless.
"He's Italian, Jean. A European citizen."
"He's one of us,"
I say.
Not really.
So that's it? He starts shuffling papers on his desk. Morgan's classic, this meeting is now over, tell.
Sorry, Jean. Call me when the mice are ready, okay?
Sure. I turn to leave his office. By the way, where's Lynn?
No idea,
he says, and his eyes move up and to the left. 55. As I ride the elevator down to the basement, a series of horrible vignettes flashes through my mind. Doctors in France, their brains intact in all but one place, are unable to process the instructions on a bottle of hand sanitizer, let alone talk to their patients, write prescriptions, perform surgery. German stockbrokers will happily tell their clients to dig instead of buy and fork instead of sell. An airline pilot in Spain, charged with the safe delivery of 200 passengers, interprets the warnings of an air traffic controller as a raunchy joke and laughs as her craft dives into Mediterranean waters. And so on, until an entire continent is drowning in a languageless chaos, ripe to be taken over.
You let me know if you need anything,
Sergeant Petrosky says when the elevator reaches the first floor. He steps out, not looking back, and takes his post at the checkout point as five men file in through the main doors. So, Lorenzo and I aren't the only ones working today. Kel fucking surprise. I continue down to the basement, every second feeling like another step on a journey to hell. Inside the lab, Lorenzo is sitting before two cages of mice, studying paperwork.
Group one,
he says quietly. He doesn't need to say anything. The cage labeled one is a circus of frisky rodents, chattering and squeaking, milling about their little mouse community as if they're at a church social. The second cage holds a dozen lifeless creatures, their furry bodies already stiffening with rigor. I hate myself for giving them names. Mice don't have the capacity for language, but we didn't need them to, not for this final test. Because of Lynn's previous work, thankfully, I didn't have to take part in the ape experiments of 2 years ago. We already isolated the neurolinguistic components of our serum. The mice today serve a single purpose, to test the two neuroproteins Lorenzo developed. None of us wants to inject a human subject with a toxin. But of course, this is exactly what will happen. I sit next to Lorenzo and slide one of the blank lab reports from his pile toward me. In small letters, I write one word in the top corner of the sheet, covering it over with my other hand. Bioweapon. As soon as he's read it, I crumple the page and take it through the internal door to the biochem lab. Lorenzo follows, and together we watch the paper turn yellow, then black, as it disintegrates in the blue flame of a Bunsen burner.
You're sure?
He says, twisting the sink tap open and staring at the ashes.
No, but it makes sense.
I tell him about my conversation with Morgan upstairs.
Think about it, Enzo.
Project Anti-Wernicke, Project Wernicke, and Project Water Solubility. Injections take time. Rounding people up, training the medical techs, that would give them a chance to escape. Spike a city's water supply, though, and you might as well drop a neutron bomb. I snap my fingers. Bang. But without the sound.
That's insane,
Lorenzo says. So is Reverend Carl. And by the way, I say, wiping down the epoxy resin counter, getting rid of all traces of burned paper before we call Morgan downstairs. Our fearless leader wants the trial scheduled for tomorrow.
They're moving fast.
Yes, they are. I let Lorenzo call Morgan on the intercom so I don't have to talk to the son of a bitch any more than absolutely necessary. Meanwhile, I prep vials of the first neuroprotein serum and fill out the day's report. The mice, the dead ones, I lock inside a freezer so Lynn can work her post-mortem magic on them when she gets here. If Lynn ever gets here. She didn't say anything to you yesterday, did she? I ask when Lorenzo is off the intercom. He shakes his head.
Only that she was going to meet a friend for dinner.
Which friend?
You remember Isabel?
How could I forget? I say. Isabel Gerber used to hang about our department when she wasn't teaching advanced Spanish conversation. Argentine, but of Swiss descent, she stood a foot taller than Lynn, wore her hair in a blonde waterfall down her back, and spoke with a slight and charming lisp. The two women were poster girls for polar opposites, but they clicked in every way a couple can click. Until last year, when they cut it off, canceled their engagement, and did what every gay man and woman had to do to avoid being shipped off to a camp. They never spoke to each other again. Not that there was a hell of a lot to talk about once Lynn's and Isabel's wrist counters went on. "I hope they're being careful," I say. The thought of Lynn, big-brained and small-bodied, working off her sins of the flesh with her bare hands, makes me cringe. Jackie could deal with that shit, but Lynn's not Jackie. And then another, more sinister thought weasels its way in. What if we're all being followed? I shake the question from my head. There's no room for any more thoughts, not one single neuron left to spare, and wash dead mouse off my hands while we wait for Morgan.
"So, Monday,"
Lorenzo says. He's not talking about work. "Monday. Afternoon." The clock on the lab wall says 5. I have less than 48 hours to make what I know will be an irreversible decision. My parents, this baby the size of an orange inside me, and Lorenzo balance on one side of the scale. Patrick and the kids on the other. Two seemingly inevitable but different fates hang over each choice like storm clouds. Stay and wait for Reverend Carl to ratchet up his terrible game, or go and watch Europe crumble to its knees, close up, front row, best seats in the house. Next to me, Lorenzo inches closer, enough so that our hands touch. It's a solid feeling, those fingers of his brushing mine. But it's not enough. 56. It's nearly 7 o'clock by the time I pull my Honda into the driveway. The sky is still light enough that I can't imagine winter or the darkness it brings. At this time of year, I always fool myself into thinking winter won't come. But it will. It always does. Patrick has told Sonia and the twins a white lie, although I'm not sure how white it is, which explains why they're in the middle of 3 simultaneous board games instead of moping about Steven's absence. Sonia breaks away from her brothers to hug me.
"I'm winning," she says. "Again!"
I raise an eyebrow at Patrick.
"I said he went to stay with a friend for a couple of days,"
he tells me, then glances over at the kids and their forest of plastic pieces.
"Sam, Leo, watch your sister. Your mom and I are going outside for a few minutes."
"We are?" I say.
"We are. Here, Jean."
He hands me the bottle of beer he's just popped the cap off of.
"You might need this."
Jean. Not babe or hun, but Jean. Patrick's in business mode. Or he's pissed off, which makes sense. In the past 24 hours, I've committed 2 crimes. Maybe more if I throw in tampering with the mail.
"Come on."
He opens the back door and leads me as far from the house as possible.
"Got anything you want to tell me?"
I swallow, not sure which is worse, stealing the project envelope and reading it, or spending half of the afternoon with Lorenzo. Or, I think, being 2.5 months pregnant. Don't forget that one, Jean. He brushes a stray lock of hair from his forehead.
"Look, I know you were in my office."
"I wanted to FaceTime my father." I lie.
"Nice try, babe, but no. I checked the call log on the kitchen phone."
Well, if nothing else, we're back to babe. He sits down on one side of the bench, pulling me to join him. I back away.
"I'm not going to bite, you know," he says.
Automatically, my right hand moves up to my collar, and I tug the material closer around my neck, just in case I've brought home any souvenirs from the crab shack.
"Okay,"
I say, and sit next to him.
"I saw a man executed once,"
he says, staring straight ahead into the thicket of azaleas now past their late spring flush of color.
"It was last September. September 1st, actually. At 2:23 in the afternoon.
I don't know what to say, so I ask the first question that pops into mind. You remember the time? The exact time?
Yeah. I never saw a man or woman die before that. Hell, I never saw an animal die. Kinda sticks in your brain, you know? Anyway, he was from my office. One of the junior scientists, worked on liaisons between the administration and the other organizations, National Science Foundation, Centers for Disease Control, NIMH, stuff like that. He was always throwing out those acronyms, Jimbo was. His name was Jim Borden, but we all called him Jimbo. Good guy. Had a young wife and a girl about Sonia's age, maybe a year younger. He liked to tell jokes. That's what I remember about him. Isn't that funny, Jean?
It isn't, but I say it is. Patrick takes a swallow of beer and smacks his lips.
The other funny thing? Jimbo was always blinking. I mean, like the way you blink when you've got a stray eyelash or a fleck of dust. He would do it in threes. Blink, blink, blink. Not to everyone, but I'd catch him at it every so often. Ever see anyone do that?
I nod.
Yeah. So Jimbo kept his head down most of the time, shuffling around papers and making copies. Every afternoon, around three, he'd leave the office saying he had a meeting with some guy across town. He'd pack up his briefcase and walk right out the door. I don't know if anyone noticed, not at first, but when he came back, that briefcase seemed lighter. You could tell by watching the way he swung it. I never said anything about that. Not to anyone.
My beer is warm now, and I don't want it. I set the bottle down on the flagstone and turn back to Patrick. But someone caught him.
Someone always catches them, babe. Always. Sooner or later, you fuck up.
There's a pause, and then...
I don't mean you. I mean you, like, in the general sense.
He pats my hand, and all I notice is how clean his hands are.
He must have seen it coming. Jimbo, that is. Because the week before they shot him, he came to me, asked if I was as pure as the rest of them.
Patrick laughs lightly, but there's no humor in it.
Guess I don't look like a bad guy, eh?
No, you don't. I've never thought of Patrick as a bad guy, only a keep-your-head-down-and-shut-up kind of guy. But I don't say this. I know where the conversation is going.
Jimbo left something for me, before they took him out of the office in handcuffs. Just a name and a number. Said it was my decision whether to make contact or not, and that he hoped I would, but wouldn't hold it against me if I stepped aside. That's how I got in touch with Dell. You saw what happened to Dell this morning.
Yeah.
They'll shoot him, you know. Like they shot Jim Borden. They put us in a bus, Jean. Well, two buses. Drove us up to Fort Meade, not saying a word about where we were headed. Some team-building exercise was the rumor. I can still see him. I see him every single day at 2:23 in the afternoon. Jimbo, there, cuffed to a post, staring out at all of us as Reverend Carl read the scripture. Glory, glory, fucking hallelujah, we've got a fox in the henhouse, men, and there's only one way to deal with a prying fox. Thomas, you remember Thomas, well, it was that son of a bitch who did the shooting. No trial, no jury of peers, no last request. They just fucking shot him, there in the rifle range of Fort Meade. I watched Jimbo go down, slump down the pole he was cuffed to, watched him bleed out life onto a patch of sand that was already stained red.
Patrick leans over, picks up my beer, and swallows it down in one long gulp.
Anyway, that's why I didn't tell you. When they come for me, it's better if you don't know anything.
When, not if. But I do now, I say.
I guess you do, babe. I guess you do.
Stephen? I don't want to ask the question, but I can't help myself. If he makes it up to North Dakota, and they find him... Instead of answering, Patrick folds himself forward, head buried in his hands. 57. There's no love tonight, but there is. We put three children to bed and silently make a wish for Stephen, that he turns back before it's too late. Then Patrick takes me to bed, wrapping himself around me.
You need to get out,
he says.
Any way you can.
I can't, I say, even though I can.
You know someone.